not normally the person she'd like run up to and give a hug on the street to, you know, but because she knows someone like that, like she knows someone like that homeless person, because she knows someone like that, it extends. And you know, these barriers between each other, between us, start to like drop.
No strangers.
Yeah.
And we can be like inclusive to all those voices.
Absolutely.
Any last words?
Not particularly. I mean, I have a lot of responses to things that both Bishop and the sister have said, but to wrap it up, the main thing I guess I would say is, like Bishop Packard was saying, the mutual inspiration that's coming from different people's movements that are raging right now all around the globe is huge. I mean, that is where Occupy came from and is where now some of those movements came from, and then it's where the next chapter in the U.S. is going to come from. And the fact is, maybe we don't need to feel the pressure in Occupy Wall Street, New York, to be perfect all of the time. And that if we just keep hope and keep relationships going and keep ideas going, there is good reason, with or without us, to protest and resist all around the world. And it's going on, and it's going to keep going. So that makes me hopeful.
Thank you all. I really appreciate it. And thanks for your sacrifices.
Thank you for listening to Occupy Wall Street Radio. This program airs every Monday through Friday on WBAI 99.5 FM from 6:30 to 7 p.m. Thank you for listening, and please remember to support listener-sponsored free speech radio.
And the time is just about 7 o'clock p.m. You are listening to WBAI 99.5 FM New York, and it's just about time for another exciting edition of Off the Hook.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. But if they could, they would. For they live on for the best, expect the worst. I hope that's understood. On the limbo.
Good evening to you. The show is Off the Hook, and it's an unusual day today. As you may have heard, if you follow us on Twitter at 2600, or if you follow Hope Number 9, we've had some computer difficulties, but we're on our way back from those. Right now, our regular host, Emmanuel, last I saw of him, he was headed toward the colo with a large shovel. But so today, this is Rob T. Firefly here with you. I am joined in the studio by Mike.
Hello.
And by Jim.
Ah.
There you are. And on the phone, we should have Bernie S. from somewhere in Pennsylvania.
Greetings from Pennsylvania.
Greetings, Bernie. Did you cause this computer crash?
No. I'm partly wondering if it could be the powers that be trying to sabotage the Hope Conference, which is coming up in just a couple of weeks. But, you know, it could be just one of those entropy things. Or human error.
Yeah, I heard it was caused by a sysadmin. I didn't know if that was you or not.
It was not me. I am not the sysadmin who caused that problem. But I'm glad I'm not, too, because I have lots of egg on my face.
So for people who don't know, the main 2600 server crashed, and it can't be rebooted or something. So you can still go to the website if you remember to type all these W's, perhaps, www.hope.net. Works for some people. We are working, well, not we because we're on the radio, but Emmanuel and others are working to bring it back up because the Hope Conference is just like, what, a week and a half away, 2 weeks away?
Something crazy like that. It's creeping up on us.
July 13th, 14th, and 15th.
Yeah, but Friday, how many weeks away is that?
Well, it's 10 days or something? I don't know.
That's way too soon.
It's 2 weeks and change.
It's soon enough that our ability to do math has already been shot.
But pre-registration is still open. If you have trouble getting to our own sites, you can always go to store.2600.com, which is hosted elsewhere, and click the Hope Number 9 button, and you will still be able to pre-register in the very limited amount of time that you have left to do so.
All right. What are you working on for Hope, Bernie? Anything in particular?
A lot of news this week?
I'm
not doing any talks this year, but I'm, along with yourself and others, we have arranged about 100 different talks with some really good speakers.
It's insane how many we have.
It's nuts. I think it's more than ever, isn't it?
I think so, yeah. I mean, the talks are starting at 10, and they're going past midnight. I don't know. Well, I know no one could possibly see them all because there's three going on at a time. But it's insane how much stuff we have.
It is a intellectual content smorgasbord, and it's like everything you wanted to know but were afraid to ask or didn't know who to ask about all kinds of aspects of our community: hacking, freaking, surveillance, counter surveillance, lockpicking, security, politics, censorship, you name it.
I actually got an email this week from our friends at the Electronic Frontier Foundation encouraging me to go to Hope, which was thoughtful of them, but highlighting all the talks that the EFF or EFF staffers will be giving at Hope, and there's like six of them.
I'm impressed. That is a huge showing. EFF has been a big supporter of us over the years, and we like to support them and give them a voice in big public forums. So great lineup of talks. EFF, as not all of our listeners know, are at EFF.org, is a group of attorneys and other technologists who basically fight for our digital rights, our rights online, our rights pertaining to technology, privacy, censorship, that sort of thing. And they do a really good job with not a ton of money. I think the ACLU is going to be at this year's conference also giving a talk.
Only one talk from the ACLU.
Just one talk, right. But it's really good to see people from the legal community who get it, that understand this confluence of technology and our rights and how some of those rights are just getting trampled because law enforcement or legislators don't understand what's really going on. Or maybe they do understand and they don't care. So
yeah, and there's just such an insane mix of different subjects. It's not all hardcore legal stuff. There's some fun stuff, too. And you can see the schedule. Last I checked, the site was still up, hopenumber9.net. And you can check out the schedule there, which was recently posted and made public, the full schedule. You can also consider that there is a fourth track that is unscheduled that people who just turn up to the conference and want to give a talk can sign out a block of time for. So that track, we don't even know what's going to be in it, but there will be things there. And so come for the scheduled talks, stay for the unscheduled talks, and more.
And we have workshops.
We've got workshops. We've got all sorts of craziness in the works, and I think it's going to be really cool.
It's kind of insane. I mean, I was talking with a friend this weekend whose son has autism, and we have a talk about autism, so I was very excited to see that talk. I don't know a lot about the topic, but the friend does, and was saying it's very unusual that you have a talk about autism with actual people with autism on it. That's apparently not the done thing in some circles. And I think that's really a theme of our conference. We have a talk about X by people who are doing X. We have a talk about the law from lawyers. We have a talk about autism from people with autism. We have a talk about security from security researchers. We have several such talks. And it just goes on. Down the list, you have this huge variety of topics, all from people who are, or mostly from people who are doing it.
Yeah, and that's really one of the special things about HOPE. It's just a product of so many eclectic people in all these walks of life coming together to do this. A bit more about what we've got coming up at HOPE in a short while. I'd like to touch on some news that's happened this week. First things first, we all know about the O'Dwyer case, where a young man from the United Kingdom is being threatened with extradition to the United States for running a website which linked to copyrighted material on other sites. And the big news in that this past week was that Jimmy Wales, the founder of Wikipedia, has started a petition asking for the extradition to be fought and struck down. And last I checked, there were about 80,000 signatures on it after, I think, a day or two. We of course had
Julia
O'Dwyer. Thank you, Bernie. We had Julia O'Dwyer as a guest on the show some time ago, and Emmanuel and Kyle also visited with Julia when they visited the UK recently. She is a great source online if you're interested in this case. Of course, all the news and stuff that's going on with it. If you're on Twitter, you can follow her at J.R. O'Dwyer. That's J.R.O.D.W.Y.E.R.
Well, that's so the petition, I guess. No, yes. News though, just petitions.
Yeah, just the petition. It's on change.org, and it's on their front page, and it's I think one of their larger petitions at the moment.
I think a member of parliament, British parliament, someone from a member of parliament from the Labour Party has also voiced his concern and is asking that his government not allow this extradition to take place. And I think the Guardian, a renowned newspaper in the UK, has just published an editorial opposing this extradition as well. Mind you, this guy did not violate any laws in his country. And
right.
It would be a very dangerous precedent if countries can start reaching across other countries' borders and charging them with violating laws that happened in a foreign country. It's insane. I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of laws in other countries against things that are perfectly legal in the United States, and we don't want that to happen either. So this is important to everybody in the world, I think.
Absolutely.
I have other British legal news, which
yeah.
is...
Yeah, there seems to be a lot coming out of Britain this week. What else have we got?
Two people from Lulzsack have pled guilty to what this newspaper describes as a slew of computer crimes on Monday. This is the latest blow against online miscreants whose exploits have grabbed headlines and embarrassed governments around the world. They pled guilty. It doesn't say what they pled guilty to. They pled guilty to conspiring with other inmates of other members of Lulzsack to attack government media and law enforcement websites last year. This, according to an official at the Crown Court.
So, a slew of acts. Is a slew a legal term of art, like an ounce or a gram?
It's like a flock of sheep.
Okay. I wonder how many. Just a single slew, or was it multiple slews they were alleged to have? This is just crazy. These folks who were quite young, I believe, are. What are they? They're just barely.
They're 20 and 19 years old.
Yeah, they're looking at potentially years in federal prison.
Crown prison.
Yes. Crown prison.
Or whatever they call it over there.
Yeah, and of course,
they're going to get crowned.
Yeah, and they'll get crowned all right, especially if they then get extradited to the United States as well.
So I guess what they're accused of doing is actually a crime in the UK. Maybe, or at least they pled guilty to a crime in the UK. So there's some sense in charging them in the UK. who knows if they've actually done it or if they or they just pled guilty to avoid further trouble. There's two more defendants, one who's 25 and one who's 17, who have pled not guilty, and they're going to face trial next April. I believe we have Emmanuel now on the line.
Fantastic guest, Mike. Yeah, I am calling in. I have not been able to hear the radio. I have not been able to even participate in most things going on in the world. Is there anything I should know other than me not being here?
We've already started several fires in the studio, but we probably got them in hand.
Okay, good, good. Well, that's somehow reassuring. What did you tell the folks as far as why I wasn't there?
We told them it was because you were in federal prison.
Okay, all right. You went with that story then.
Yeah.
You're probably in a cage right now.
I'm sorry, Bernie?
I said you probably are in a cage right now if you're at a co-location.
Well,
are you in a cage?
Okay, so you told them that much. Good, okay. I stepped out of the cage to give the update. Basically, I'm going to be blunt here as far as what happened. This is not anything to be blamed on Verizon. This was completely on our side. Basically, sometimes what happens is you have system administrators who don't think too much about the consequences of their actions, and they move forward with an update before checking to see if everything is stable and checking to see if everything is compatible. And sometimes you get this kind of arrogance where someone says, oh, I know what I'm doing, and whatever anybody else is working on, it doesn't matter. That's kind of what happened here. One of our sysadmins, who is not going to be a sysadmin anymore, did this, and without regard for what users were doing, without regard for the system stability. System crashed, did not come back up. We spent the last basically 24 hours frantically trying to figure out why not. And we finally, Fiber Optic is here with me. We came into the colo, and we have the machine back. We were able to get it back, and now we're just trying to figure out what went wrong and how to prevent it from happening again. So we apologize to anybody who's trying to communicate with us, and we apologize to anybody else that might have been affected by this one way or another. That goes everybody on the highways today that I was, like, very angry at, or everybody I passed in the street, or just my friends that I have not been communicating very positively with. It's extremely frustrating when we've got this conference coming up and we can't talk to anybody or we can't access the things that we need to access. So we have the situation under control now, and we're going to take steps to make sure it doesn't happen again. But I apologize to everybody for the inconvenience and the craziness that's been going on.
It's a good thing, Emmanuel, that you didn't have your hands full with anything else when this happened.
Yeah, that's really funny, Barney, because, you know, if you had plotted, if you had thought, when's the best time to really screw somebody over to do this, you would have picked exactly almost to the minute is when this happened. You know, a word to system administrators, when you have a major project coming up, not the time to start messing around with the system and seeing what will happen if you install this particular program. So we're going to establish some ground rules where we think more about the users and the bigger projects before we think about experimenting with the OS.
Well, I think our listeners would be interested in a post-mortem at some future off the hook as to exactly what happened and so that they can avoid making the same mistake.
Brian, I'm not going to get violent. I'm not going to kill him. I'm just going to restrict the access so that, you know, he or she does not have the ability to do this again.
I didn't mean a biological post-mortem, but anyway.
Oh, you missed the situation. Yeah, of course. We'll let people know what happened with the actual system. Maybe we'll talk about it at the conference. Maybe it'll be an interesting little side note.
Hey, Emmanuel, one of our former guests on this show, you may remember him, Ryan Harris. He went by the hacker name Der Engel. He published a book called Hacking the Cable Modem.
I do remember.
Yeah, yeah. And, in fact, we had him on a guest during a fundraiser show back in 2006, in October, I think, and we offered copies of his book as a premium to our supportive listeners, and we also gave away a galley copy of his book a few months earlier at Hope Number 6. And today, he was charged a couple years ago by the FBI for showing people how to hack their cable modems, how to uncap them, because Comcast was found to be throttling people's internet speeds, like when they're doing peer-to-peer protocol, that kind of stuff. And they got caught and fined by the federal government for that. But at the same time, people like Ryan were allowing cable modem users to circumvent these illegal restrictions that Comcast was putting on them. Well, Ryan was took his case to trial a few months ago, and he was found guilty of these unauthorized access.
I mean,
and today he was sentenced to 3 years in federal prison, plus 3 years of supervised release, plus over $200,000 in restitution and fines.
I'm sorry, what did he do?
His actual charges I have here in front of me.
Yeah, legal lease is fun, but what did he do?
Well, he made available tools, software and hardware, for people to hack their cable modems. Basically change the MAC address and to basically change the firmware in their cable modems. This isn't like so you could steal cable modem servers necessarily, but just so you could take control of your cable modem and prevent any tapping or throttling of it. Or if you wanted to have a cable modem in two different locations and you're still paying your bill and you didn't want to have to physically move the cable modem from one address to another, that's considered fraud, apparently. And he was charged with let's see here. If I have it right here.
But he caused $200,000. Did he steal $200,000 from the cable company?
Well, the press release from the feds has not come out yet because he was just sentenced a couple, 3 hours ago. But he was, I guess what was the feds do is they calculate how much fraud could have occurred with all the hardware and software he had made available to people, and then they extrapolate it, and then they probably multiply it by some factor, the speed of light. And they come up with a dollar figure that you have to pay back. So, you know, that's what it comes down to. But 3 years in federal prison, three more years of parole-like conditions on top of that, $50,000 in fines and $152,000 in change that he's got to pay Comcast. He was not alleged to have stolen any cable modem service. So that's the main point.
That's I mean, it's kind of clever. If I wanted to, like, cause $200,000 worth of damage, I feel like I would have to actually take, you know, maybe at least half that from someone.
Or just break something large.
If you did that, you'd probably get away with it. Because taking tangible things is it's almost encouraged.
So anyway, I'll announce his address over the air once we know where he's going to be imprisoned. But yeah, that's not a joke. You know, he was charged with conspiracy, wire fraud, and computer fraud. Those are the charges. And someone who worked with him on this project, a co-conspirator, was asked by the FBI to testify against Ryan. And was granted.
We need to talk about this more. Actually, we need to get back into the colo because we have a bit of a crisis I got to deal with right now.
All right, I'll let you go.
I just want to update the folks and have a good show.
Good luck.
I'll be back next week.
Okay, thank you for the updates, Emmanuel.
I'll wrap this up quick. Basically, the co-defendant was asked by the FBI to testify against Ryan Harris in exchange for full immunity, and the co-conspirator did so and walked away scot-free without any charges or fines or anything. So that's how it works in the judicial system here in this country.
So we've lost Emmanuel, but we do have on the phone Lisa Shea, who's going to be one of our speakers at HOPE. Are you there, Lisa?
Yes, I am.
So the title of your talk is Countermeasures, Proactive Self-Defense Against Ubiquitous Surveillance. What does that mean for our listeners?
Well, what my co-researcher Greg Conte and I have been looking at is this amazing network of ubiquitous sensors that are just all around us today, from sensors we carry on our person to ones that are in our homes to ones that are in our communities and ones that are in place at, say, airports. And it seems like everywhere you go, you encounter sensors. And they provide a variety of benefits, but our concern is that these systems could be networked together. And the idea of having network surveillance systems with potentially unfettered expansion could have some really frightening second-order effects that could threaten our privacy. So our talk is to expose the audience to these kinds of sensor networks that are either in place or coming, and then talk about ways that individuals could protect themselves, and also the audience at the HOPE conference have unique skills and knowledge and experiences that could help them, that could help deflect the trajectory of some of these systems and influence policy and decision makers so that we have systems that benefit society without adverse effects on our privacy and our free way of life.
And Lisa?
Yes.
This is Bernie in Pennsylvania. I just wanted to point out, if it wasn't clear to our listeners, that these aren't just sort of sensors that are out there somewhere, you don't know where they are. Probably most of our listeners are carrying around these sensors with them most
of
the time.
Absolutely. Everything from your smartphone to a portable electronic device to many of us have smart cards that we use to access our places of work. Or just think about, I live in New York. I travel across a variety of bridges. I've got a very convenient EasyPass system in my car that allows me to quickly go through toll booths. But that's a sensor network. We actually did a little study that basically from the moment you wake up until the moment you go to bed, just an average person experiences dozens of these sensors just in our daily lives.
Wow. And most of these sensors are linked to our identities, aren't they? I mean, you can't buy an EasyPass. I checked into this recently. You cannot buy an EasyPass anonymously with cash. It has to be tied not only to your identity, but to the registration of your motor vehicle. Cell phones, for the most part, are tied to your identity when you get a contract, a cell phone contract. So these are directly tied to who we are, and our location and what we're doing, and it's something
absolutely.
I'm glad you're making people aware of.
And that's where the concern can come in, because if our physical location, because of many of our cell phones have GPS, so not only is our identity known, but our location's known, that can be tied to our credit cards through the database of the cell phone companies. So there's potential for third parties to know a great deal about us and about just the things that we do on a daily basis without us realizing it or being aware that other people might have access to it. And we value a free society, and we just want to make sure that as these systems become more and more prevalent, that the people who emplace these systems think about what can they be used for, what are their vulnerabilities, and what regulatory mechanisms should we put in place to protect people's identity or protect people's free way of life.
And Lisa, I would I'd like to ask, what sparked your interest in this subject?
Well, I'm an academic. I'm an electrical engineer by trade. I've studied wireless networks and sensor networks just in an academic setting, and I have a colleague, Greg Conti, who's done a lot of research and, in fact, has spoken at previous HOPE conferences about security and privacy, especially in the computer field. Greg even wrote a book about Googling security. And he's just down the hall from me, and so one day we just started talking about my interest and knowledge in sensors and his interest and knowledge in networks and privacy and the erosion of privacy. And we thought, gee, this is an area that hasn't been discussed enough, hasn't been studied enough, and there are some real concerns that we want to make people aware of.
And Lisa, this isn't just some academic talk you're going to be giving at the HOPE conference. You and Greg are going to be offering specific practical techniques for defeating or degrading the sorts of tracking with sensors and monitoring. Isn't that right?
Well, yes. We look at it from the perspective of an individual. There are some common sense things that you can do to protect yourself that are just sort of best practices that, you know, if we think about owning computers, once upon a time we didn't think much about antivirus software. We didn't think much about keeping systems patched and updated, and now we do. And we're kind of at that new era in this ubiquitously networked sensor environment. That, you know, what are things that you want to do just to protect yourself, so that if you are giving away information, you're doing it consciously, and you're understanding what the trade-offs are.
I'm curious what you think the balance is or should be between things that we do as individuals to protect our own privacy and things that the people who set up these sensor networks do or ought to be doing on their part.
Well, that's an area that we're actively studying and discussing. That's certainly not a solved problem. That's something that we want to have public discourse with. We actually did a talk in April at a conference called We Robot in Miami at the University of Miami Law School, where Greg and I collaborated with lawyer Woody Hartzog and a couple other colleagues of ours from West Point, looking at automated law enforcement systems and, you know, what is the balance? Are there legal and ethical and policy regulations that should be put in place to prevent us living in a dystopia? We certainly want to avoid that. And so it's not an issue that has a clear and defined answer. It depends a lot on which systems we're talking about. I mean, certain ones, we value having the ability to communicate everywhere, having cell phones. We like having cameras on all our cell phones. We like having GPS in our cell phones so that if we do get in an accident or an emergency, the 911 system can find us. So there's certainly benefits to all of this technology, but we do want to raise the question of, okay, as this technology goes forward and it becomes more networked and more linked, what are the dangers? What can we do to prevent them? And can we design for safety and design these systems with privacy and protections built in rather than fixing them after the fact?
And Lisa, I think it's not just an issue of, well, nobody thought that this stuff could have been abused ahead of time. I remember quite a few years ago when there was a lot of arguments from the law enforcement community that a cell phone should all be E911 compliant. In other words, be able to be tracked within a very close location, because you could always get locked in the trunk of your car by a kidnapper, and if you call 911, then the 911 center would know exactly where you are, which obviously it happens all the time. And so those were the arguments. And so then cell phones were required by FCC regulations to be equipped with a GPS.
Yes.
And other tracking mechanisms by triangulating through cell sites and so forth. But it wasn't turned off when you weren't making a 911 call.
Right.
So it wasn't just the 911 calls that were being tracked. It was all the calls, locations being tracked, and your location even when you weren't making calls. And so
absolutely, yes.
So this mission creep thing is happening, not just with that, with EasyPass. There's a reason why EasyPass needs to be able to, I guess, when I tried to buy one the other day anonymously, just for research purposes, I was told that it had to be tied to your motor vehicle license plate number, because if the thing malfunctions, they always take a picture of your license plate when you go through the toll booth, and then they'll know where to send the fine to and the charges if the EasyPass malfunctions. Mm-hmm. So then I'm like, well, gee, what do they do with all that data? With every single car going through every toll booth, they have optical character recognition cameras. Are they using that only for toll enforcement? Or what are they also using it for? Who makes these decisions? And I think this is really important stuff to discuss.
Absolutely. You've hit the nail right on the head, because we have these systems in place right now that have a multitude of uses. Many of them are absolutely legitimate and definitely beneficial. I like not having to wait in line at the bridge to pay my $1.50 to go across the river. But on the other hand, that's all that I want that service for, not for tracking my comings and goings on a daily basis.
We're speaking with Lisa Shea, who is presenting on Countermeasures, Proactive Self-Defense Against Ubiquitous Surveillance at the HOPE No. 9 conference coming up in a couple of weeks. More information on hope.net. Lisa, if I may ask, both you and Greg Conti come from a military background, and I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about what you might think that experience might lend to your insight on this particular subject.
Greg and I both teach at West Point, which is a accredited four-year institution, and one of the great benefits of being faculty members at West Point is that we have academic freedom. And so we are free to investigate and explore areas of research that we find interesting and compelling and important. And so we're looking at this really from, you know, an academic perspective, as what is the nature of these systems, where are they located, who emplaces them and why, and are the people who that emplace these systems the end users, or are there other end users, and how secure is the system as a whole, because fundamentally these are networks of computer systems, and we all know that those have vulnerabilities, especially if the thought of security wasn't designed into the systems to begin with. So that's the way we're approaching the topic.
I wonder if it's almost overstating the case to call some of these privacy problems vulnerabilities. Some of them are certainly by design.
Well, sure, absolutely. I mean, we look at the motivations of the organizations that put these systems in place, and you know, certainly there's an increased awareness of security after 9/11. They're in place for public safety and for national security. So there's a variety of motives that go into emplacing these systems. And we just believe that the more transparency there is, if people sign up for systems knowing what they're used for, then they're making a judgment based on reason. If they sign up for systems, say, EasyPass or whatever, without full disclosure of where that information is being used, that's a situation that we want to avoid.
Wouldn't there be an interest in some of the entities and organizations that offer or compel people to use some of these systems? Aren't there some competing interests here? For instance, if you're trying to track criminals and terrorists, you don't want them to know how exactly they are being tracked. So isn't this sort of a sole security versus privacy argument?
Oh, absolutely. There are many competing interests. If you think about just tracking your vehicle, you want to know where you are, so you have a GPS system, but your insurance company might want to know how safely you drive, and the law enforcement agencies want to know if you ran that red light or if you're speeding. So there are absolutely a multitude of competing interests, and that's what makes these problems so challenging but also so interesting, and that's why we find them worthy of discussion at major conferences like this, so that the more we have public discourse and the more we have rational arguments about them, arguments in the positive sense of laying out the pros and cons, the costs and benefits, then we can strike a balance, because fundamentally many aspects of our life are balances in that regard.
I read an article this week about the internet provider in the Bay Area, Sonic.net, which reviewed its log-keeping policies, basically for the first time in its history. And what they discovered was that, there's use for their sysadmins to keep logs for a couple weeks, and occasionally they get a request, from law enforcement to help find a kidnapping victim or something. But the logs they were keeping longer than that were basically only useful to copyright trolls who wanted to embarrass people by suing them and claiming they had pirated pornography or something. So they said, we have done the analysis, we have figured out here is the optimum trade-off between privacy and other interests. We will keep logs henceforth for 14 days. And it's sort of amazing that they're, I don't know that they're the first internet service provider, but they're certainly one of the very few to have made this analysis in their customers' interests. And I hope that other people will start to do it.
Oh, excellent. Yes. I mean, that's great news to hear, because certainly there's information collected about all of us on the internet, and there's very little transparency about how long that data is kept and for what purposes it might be used. And then there's the whole issue of if a company goes out of business, what happens to all the data that it had collected, say, on its customers? So that's wonderful news. And perhaps having more publicity about organizations like that will motivate others or motivate the public to request that other ISPs follow suit on that sort of thing.
How do you feel about where where we seem to be headed with all this? We have another frequent speaker at our conferences, Steve Rambam, whose tagline is usually "Privacy is dead," and get over it. So, do you think we're reaching or perhaps have already reached such a point where it's really not worth it to even bother anymore to just give things up, or do you think we still have a chance?
Greg and I certainly don't think that that it's worth just giving up. I mean, certainly there are people who have very different views on privacy, and to some extent it's a little bit generational. The people, my kids who've grown up with Facebook, put a lot more out on the internet than I would ever be comfortable doing, but we certainly don't think that that's a position that society as a whole ought to take, and certainly we don't feel that way. There's definitely very different views on privacy. Daniel Solove wrote a very cogent article on the misunderstandings of privacy and the idea that, well, if you've got nothing to hide, then you shouldn't be worried about privacy. But we believe fundamentally that this is more than just that. It's about free will, and it's about what it means to be living in a free society as opposed to a police state.
Yeah, and it's interesting you mentioned the generational thing, because we are now seeing the first generation of kids who grew up from the start giving all their information willy-nilly to Facebook and social networks and things like that, and it becomes part of the routine to just post photos of where you are and what you're eating for dinner and just be comfortable with it as a fact of life. Whereas some of us older than that generation, you know, we might not have even used our own name on the internet as a kid, if we were on the internet at all. So with this new scale that's facing like kids in particular, but you know, younger people and all of us, do you think it's more of a matter of public education where people might not understand how much they're giving up by choosing to post as much as they do?
Oh, absolutely. We try. Greg and I are both educators. We both teach, and we definitely bring that out in our classes to our students, that you have to be very cognizant of what information you're giving up to whom and why, because, you know, there's certainly been lots of horror stories of people who've been burglarized because they posted that they were going on vacation, or, you know, people who have been kidnapped or molested or all sorts of other terrible things that happen to people because of information they posted without perhaps thinking more deeply about who has access to this information. And we're starting to see more attention being paid to privacy policies for these different organizations, but there's still mostly an opt-out model, not an opt-in model, and there's not as much public awareness or discourse as we feel there should be on this topic.
Lisa, there's a lot of overlap between the whole privacy versus security versus technology interests at the Hope Conference. One of our other speakers, Eben Moglen, is going to be talking about applying, I don't know if you're a science fiction fan, but I know a lot of our listeners are, applying Isaac Asimov's first law of robotics. Smartphones, arguing that in the 1960s, science fiction visionaries wrote that around in the middle of the first quarter of the 21st century, we'd be living contemporarily with robots, and that's kind of the case now. Maybe not autonomous robots, but these cell phones we carry around see everything. They're where we are, what our relationships are to other people and other devices. and they mediate an information stream about us that allows other people to predict and know our conduct and intentions and capabilities, maybe even better than we could predict ourselves. So you're going to be in some good company, and all of our speakers are going to be in good company, because there's just a confluence of really interesting conversations going on at the Hope Conference. I think your talk is on Sunday at 10 o'clock.
Yes.
And I urge our listeners who are coming to the Hope Conference to check out your panel discussion with you and Greg Conte. We know Greg's a good speaker. We can tell you're a good speaker already on the phone here.
Thank you very much.
But this is some really practical, important information for all our listeners on WBAI Off the Hook and who come to the Hope Conference, because it really concerns our future and what we value as a society as being important.
Oh, absolutely. And Greg and I were very pleased. We were honored that we were chosen to be speakers at this conference. Greg, as I said, has spoken before and has just rave reviews of the experiences that he's had at previous conferences, both the discussions, the questions and answers after his talk, and the discussions that he's had in the conference rooms with the other speakers and with the other attendees. And we are really looking forward to it. It should be a very exciting and interesting time.
Lisa, I want to thank you very much for joining us tonight and talking a little bit about what you plan to do at Hope Number 9. I'd like to take some listener phone calls. If you're able, you're welcome to stick around for those.
Oh, sure.
Okay. Give us a call. The phone number is 1-212-209-2900. And let us know what's on your mind regarding today's subjects and guest.
While we wait for the people to give us a call, I saw this story about a jail in Fulton County, which is near Atlanta, who are asking the inmates to try and break out of their own cells. And apparently if you successfully do that, you'll get free food and personal hygiene items from the commissary. The backstory is, I guess they have some locks currently that don't work very well. People can just pop them open, I guess. So they are spending $6 million to replace the locks. And before they do that, they want to make sure they work.
That's good. They're encouraging prisoners to do lock hacking. We're gonna have a whole lock picking village at the Hope Conference, where you can come and learn how to pick and manipulate locks. We're gonna have a really good talk about master keys and the master keying systems and how they work and how to exploit them. So if you're interested in locks, come to the Hope Conference for that. It makes me remember really quick when I was in federal prison years ago. I noticed that the great big keys that the guards carried around, they were like great big warded keys. They were like about an inch wide and 3 or 4 inches long, and they had notches cut in them. But guess what? There were these little sleeves that fell down that would cover all the notches. And I wondered, oh, that's really clever, because I wanted to see how the keys were cut just by looking at them. And they had that countermeasure to prevent people, because I'd heard that someone had figured out how to take pieces of plexiglass from the shop at the prison and cut their own keys and escape their cells. So, you know, countermeasures, it's all good. And I commend this prison warden for offering food and hygiene product privileges at the commissary for successfully hacking the prison locks.
Yeah, I'm sure those people that broke out of their cells all that time ago, they didn't get free food and soap for doing it.
No, they might have gotten freedom, though. You never know.
Well, everything's a trade-off.
I think they should offer more of an incentive, like time off their sentence. But, you know, that probably wouldn't fly.
Okay, 212-209-2900. Give us a call. What have we got?
Hello, you're on the air. Hello?
The internet service provider with the 14-day retention policy. Which one was that?
That is a Sonic.net. They're out in the Bay Area in California. I don't think you can get them here, but maybe someone else knows of someone here who has a similar policy.
Okay, am I on the air at this moment?
You are, yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah, some things to point out. I think it's that Congress required the GPS. Wasn't just an FCC regulation. Congress stuck that in there, and it was before 9/11.
Yes.
I remember fighting against that, writing lots of letters to Congress saying I didn't want that in my cell phone, and it went in.
Basically, the Congress does whatever the law enforcement community asks them to do, and the FCC does whatever Congress tells them to do, and and the cell phone companies do whatever the FCC tells them they have to do for the most part. So that's kind of how the chain of interests, that's the arc of that process.
Yeah, Bernie,
the voters should raise their voices a little louder on that sort of thing. We did shoot down, before 9/11, most of the contents of the Patriot Act. That's not one of them that we got shot down, but we did manage every time Bill Clinton would put one of these restrictions on our freedom up, the letters would pour in like the spy on your customer banking regulations, and they would get shot down in Congress. And then when 9/11 came along, everything went through in 3 days, or maybe even three weeks. But it was like the bill went up, and people had, Congress had 48 hours to vote against it or for it, and it was called the Patriot Act, so you had to vote for it because we'd just come under attack. And everything that Bill Clinton failed to do, and I thought he was a terrible president because he tried to do it, but in retrospect, he seems like a much better president because he did fail to do it, and Bush was the worst president because he succeeded. Obama being even worse because he made things even worse.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your phone call. 212-209-2900.
You know, Bernie, I want to say the really insane thing is that the cell phone companies and other companies like them even go beyond what the law requires in violating our privacy, and I think that's almost the really nefarious bit.
Well, it's a huge profit center for them. They make hundreds of millions of dollars a year on providing surveillance services to law enforcement agencies. I think a few years ago, someone who reported from a cellular conference, a cellular security, a wiretapping conference, said that somebody from Sprint was giving a talk and said that they had done something like 8 billion ping requests in 1 year, GPS ping requests on cell phones. That doesn't mean 8 billion people, obviously. There aren't that many people on the planet. But when a law enforcement agency orders a GPS ping request, it's usually hundreds or thousands of pings or even more on a target. So like you said, they have a profit interest in exploiting our privacy. And that's where a lot of this comes from—a profit incentive.
Yeah, it's very important to know. I'm sure Lisa has some more information on this, which she'll be sharing at the conference. But yeah, it's really important to notice that this is not just the government spying on you to get more information on what you're up to. Your information is very, very valuable. It's worth a lot of money, and there are a lot of companies who want in on that money.
All right, let's take another phone call. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello, speak up, please.
Yes. I just had a couple of questions regarding cell phone privacy as well. Just wanting to know to what degree these companies are storing our data and permanently recording it, or the NSA, that kind of thing.
Lisa, do you have any thoughts on that?
I don't have any specific data on that. I suspect that it varies from company to company, just as we see here. This one ISP has a 14-day retention policy, whereas many of us have ISPs with much longer. So I think it...
Were there any requirements within the Patriot Act that required companies to store information for extended periods, just in case kind of thing?
I don't know. I'm not a lawyer, and I'm not an expert on the
right.
Patriot Act. There's probably many other speakers at the HOPE Conference who are much better in place to answer that question.
One more time, could you say when and where is the HOPE Conference?
Sure. The HOPE Conference will be July 13 through 15, which is Friday through Sunday, at the Hotel Pennsylvania, right across the street from Penn Station.
Okay.
Yes, more information on hope.net. Okay.
All right. Thanks for that call. Let's take another one. You're on the air. Hello?
Yeah, hi. I noticed that when I... Can you hear me?
Yes, yeah. We can.
Yeah, I noticed that when I stayed in hotels last year... And I didn't take it off on my income tax. The charges that the hotel for phones, for water, and they didn't even pay it. And the English people that were staying there said, why are we paying all these taxes? And besides that, I get calls when I give information to 311. All kinds of junk companies call me. I don't know where they got my information. They're trying to sell me new cell phones, senior crap, some other kind of crap, trap of fixing things. How do they get my number? And I can't eliminate these calls. Can you tell me what to do?
I don't know if the calls, your calls are 311 or a public.
Yeah, I did call 311, and after that I get all these solicitations.
My point is, it may not have been a cause and effect with you calling 311.
No, but I'm suspecting it could be. That's my point.
There is a way around that. In Philadelphia, we have a 311 system too, but there's a number you can call instead of 311. You can call a local phone number.
Well, I can't stop them. No matter what I do, I get new ones for diabetes, for sicknesses.
You can try to put yourself on the do not call list if you.
How do you do that?
Well, do you have access to the internet?
No.
All right. Well, find a friend who does have access to the internet, and they can look up do not call list.
Oh.
It's an FCC thing, and I think it might be a Federal Trade Commission thing. Anyhow, it's a list you can get on that telemarketers are supposed to follow, not calling you if you're on that list. It doesn't mean all of them follow that rule, but a lot of them do. And I've done it for other people, and their number of calls have dropped dramatically.
Yeah.
Okay.
The other thing you can do is call the Better Business Bureau and report.
Yeah, that I can do. All right. Thank you.
Yes, indeed. Thank you for that call.
Let's try over here. You're on the air. Hello?
Hi.
Hi.
I have Hope 9 tickets that I can't use, and I wanted to make them available at cost. What's the best way to do that?
I don't know the answer to that. Bernie, do you know?
There's a forum. I think it's talk.hope.net. And again, the server's down right now, but it should probably be up in a few hours. There's a forum, talk.hope.net. If you go on there.
The forum's up, actually.
Forum is up again.
Awesome. Well, go to talk.hope.net and offer them there. Or if you're free that weekend, you could just try to scalp them in front of the hotel.
Well, that's the problem. I'm not. So let me make them available to somebody at cost. I don't want to do that.
Okay. Thanks. Well, go on that forum, and you can make arrangements with someone there. It's not exactly eBay, but you could probably find somebody there.
No, that's right. I'm not trying to start a bidding war.
Right, right.
I just want to help support the community. I can't make it. It sounds like fantastic.
We appreciate that. Sorry you can't make it.
All right. We've just got a couple of minutes left, but we can probably squeeze another call or two in. Good evening. You're on the air.
Yeah, WBAI, thank you so much for taking my call.
You're very welcome. What's on your mind?
Am I on the air?
Yes, you are.
Oh, all right. First of all, my name is John. I'm calling from Long Island. I don't want to make this too long. I'm going to have to be brief. I just wanted people to know that I've had this confirmed from a police officer. This was being done to me because I was driving with a suspended license. They're pinging, P-I-N-G, people's cell phones, all right? And they're watching you on their laptops. I know this because it was admitted to me in addition to that. I mean, this is what cops are doing now. And I know people who have had their cell phones pinged just because they were under suspicion because they were a black belt and somebody got beat up and then detectives were knocking on their door at 11 o'clock at night. I don't know if people know what's going on, but police officers now, and I've had this happen to me, once with Department of Environmental Conservation and once with Suffolk County PD, they watch you on their laptops. Everything is done on a laptop, and they watch you. And it's been done to me. Trust me. I'll come down to the station. I'll give you all the proof. Besides that, my ex-girlfriend's brother, right now, there's a big surge on Long Island in the Hopog Industrial Park with jobs. He's working on UAVs, unmanned aerial vehicles, because they've gotten a lot of contracts, and these things are for real.
Mm-hmm.
These things are being worked on. And he tells me this. So, you know what? All those people out there who are like, they're just talking. No, they're not just talking. It's here. It's now. It's happening.
Yes. Well, the unmanned drones are an interesting subject because we'll be having a couple of those at Hope, apparently. So if you've ever wanted to meet one of those in person, come on down to Hope. And, okay, let's see what else we can get.
There's a lot of interesting things to talk about. We've got just briefly time for this last call.
I wanted to talk to you tonight, and good evening, gentlemen, about the extra-legal cell phone records. Apparently, and you can, again, anyone who wants to check, just checking court records, especially civil suits involving maybe motor vehicle accidents and other agencies. Apparently, some lawyers have found a way around the restrictions that only law enforcement personnel can get this kind of data. And they get this kind of data, and then they go into court and they get a court order to retroactively make it legal so they can introduce it as evidence.
Interesting. Okay. Well, thank you very much for that phone call. I'd like to thank our guest, Lisa Shea. Come see her speak at Hope number 9 coming up this July.
And hundreds of other people.
And just come meet a great community and check out a great conference. Okay. For Off the Hook, this is Rob T. Firefly. Send us an email, oth@2600.com. If you've sent us an email over the past couple of days, send it again, because we haven't been able to get all our mail. Okay. Have a good night.
Said the carpenter, "You've had a pleasant run. So we be trotting home again, but answer came there none. And this was scarcely odd, because they'd eaten every one."
Oh man, I love the music from that show, Off the Hook. Fantastic as usual, always different. And that's what I like about them, just like WBAI, always different. So, I'm looking at the clock, and wow, it's 8 o'clock here on Wednesday, WBAI, New York 99.5 FM, June 27th. And usually, that means it's time for the personal computer shoe. All right. Go ahead, Hank. Take it away.
Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is Hank Key, and thank you, Stevie DB. And we have on the West Coast, David Perry. David, how are you doing?
I'm excellent. Hank, how are you?
Listen, it's 82 here in New York, and I think that you have better weather than us.
It's actually the same temperature here right now, but it is 3 hours earlier.
Oh, okay. And we have a special guest that you have arranged for, Dr. Richard Ford, and he is down in Florida. Dr. Ford, are you there?
Yes. Hi, good evening.
Listen, David, can you do us the honor of introducing Dr. Ford?
Dr. Richard Ford is a graduate of Oxford University. He's a full professor at the Florida Institute of Technology. He is a former editor of the Virus Bulletin magazine and is one of the world's leading experts in malware and computer security. He's married to the inimitable Sarah Gordon Ford, who is another virus expert of great renown. And I can always tell whenever Richard Ford shows up at a conference, whether it's in Barcelona or Malta or London, that it's going to be a more interesting conference. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show, Dr. Ford.
Well, thanks, David, and thanks for that beautiful introduction. I would definitely agree Sarah's inimitable.
By the way, right. Is Dr. Ford, did David kind of sort of set you up and then he's going to hit you with a hammer?
I hope not. I guess we'll find out, right?
Go ahead, Dave.
Yeah, I'm not known for hitting people with hammers. You want more like a psychopath for that. The Richard, we've been inundated with stories about the flame virus. I hesitate to call it a virus, but that'll just have to serve for right now. The flame exploit, and it's raising questions about the role of malware in warfare, and is cyber warfare happening already? Is it possible? And what should be the role of one's government in a world where cyber warfare is possible? We've actually done a podcast on this already before and have met several times to discuss these principles. I don't know if the general public knows it, but the government's been discussing this for, 20 years now?
That's right. As soon as computers started to get popular, you know, the Defense Department, who were very smart, said, gee, you know, these computer things look like they might be important. I wonder what we should do with them. And, of course, for as long as we've had networks, people have been attacking us over them, and I'm pretty sure we've been attacking them over them. I always hesitate with the word cyber war. It's like going, oh, well, this isn't air war. You know, it's not that stovepipe. But there's certainly a lot of packets going backwards and forwards that across borders that may be related to attack operations on both sides, I'm sure.
Well, the news media has a very short memory. I remember 7 or 8 years ago going to Tallinn, Estonia, with Paul Ferguson and a bunch of other crazy people to look at servers in a bank there in Estonia that were apparently attacked by the Russians or somebody in the employ of the Russians or maybe the Latvians or something. And that was heralded as the beginning of cyber warfare.
Right, I remember that. So the funniest thing is, with Flame, the thing that I find most surprising is that we seem to be surprised.
Yeah.
I don't think this was really a big shock to anybody who's in the industry. I'm surprised. The only newsworthy thing about it is the news that it's created. I mean, it is a fairly advanced piece of malware. It's got some really nice bells and whistles. It is pretty complicated, but it's not really a surprise.
Right. Well, I'm an expert in how to make a virus into a news story, and it was very carefully orchestrated the way that it was brought to the news media.
Yes, I thought that was interesting, too. We tend not to talk about our sort of kinetic operations in the same glorious detail. So I thought the way this story broke and was handled was very interesting. Of course, that's all a political thing, and I'm a tech guy, so I'm much more familiar with the tech side of things. But it was very interesting, the amount of mind share it has on the part of users. I mean, I don't know about you, I'm sure you get calls, I get emails about people sort of laying awake at night worrying about their computer from these stories. And, of course, the threat to the actual user hasn't really changed one iota.
Well, one of our mutual friends who wishes to remain anonymous told me that he thinks that what we forget about is that the announcement itself may be a piece of psychological warfare.
Well, that's
we
right.
may be demonstrating, and this matches up. You told me a long time ago that you thought Stuxnet had more was too easily discovered to be a really secret piece of malware.
Yeah, it felt like a demo when I played with it. It's like, oh, look what I can do. You should be afraid. And
this one has the kitchen sink in it. It has an entire development system built into it. But the main question I wanted to raise is cyber warfare. Is it here? Are we way past that now? Is there stuff happening that we're not talking about? Is it possible that drone that was brought down into Tehran was really brought down by hackers on the ground?
Gosh, there's a lot of questions that you stacked up for me in one long line, David. So I'll try and wrap my arms around them. With the drone, who knows? Anything's possible. Command and control is often a weak link when we look at these things. Cyber war is a term that I always sort of sets my teeth a little bit on edge, like I've just chewed on a little piece of silver foil, because there's something. It sort of isolates the cyber. And I think one of the mistakes we make is we make these little artificial stovepipes. A long time ago, and I think you'll remember this, it was pre-9/11, Sarah and I think that's about the right date, wrote a paper on cyber terrorism. And around that time, everybody was fussing about cyber terrorism. And these terms sort of make it sound sort of more special than it is. I mean, the idea of playing with each other's communications channels and fooling with them has been around since the dawn of time. You can go back to World War II and you look at, the Allies breaking the Enigma crypto system and, the development really of the first modern day computer. This stuff's been around since the dawn of time and will continue to be around. Until, we throw up our hands and stop using computers, which doesn't seem likely anytime soon.
I'm going to reiterate that last point that you made. The major places in the world where computers were invented, they were invented as weapons of war. Both the ENIAC, which was invented as a shell trajectory figuring computer, and the Colossus at Bletchley Park, which was invented to break the Enigma code. Both invented in World War II for the purposes of warfare.
Absolutely, and as a completely random aside, if any of the listeners ever have the chance to visit Bletchley Park in the UK, I would thoroughly recommend it. It's a really interesting experience to see what
it's the home of the UK Museum of Computers, as well as the reconstructed Colossus and the tribute to, and now I can't remember his name, Alan Turing.
Dr. Ford, let me just jump in and ask a question. We tend to think of cyber warfare as between enemies, but how prevalent is it with friendly nations spying on each other's?
Well, again, it's conjecture, obviously. But if you look at the role of, why treat cyber anything as something special? So let's just treat it as a source of intelligence. In the traditional cloak-and-dagger world of the intelligence services, do friendlies spy on each other and keep a careful eye on each other? Absolutely. And so my question would be, why would we expect cyber operations to be any different if we were going to extend that thinking into the cyber domain?
Well, let me ask you.
I do think it lowers the cost of spying, however, immensely.
Let me ask this question. Do governments, on behalf of industry, do industrial spying?
I am sure that there is state-sponsored theft of IP from various countries around the world. I'm sure that's happened. I'm sure it will continue to happen. However, again, a lot of this is not really talked about in the public eye. And hard facts are sometimes hard to put your arms around. So my answer is it seems very likely that kind of thing's going on. But if you ask me today, well, you can give me an example. I would be hesitant to do that on air.
Just kidding. I think it's obvious that in terms of industrial espionage, that all companies have opened their door and put on their web page information that used to be considered proprietary. You can hunt down information. You can find out about, you know, monthly return rates on corporations. You can find about their sales figures. You can track which of their employees are doing the best. You can find out who works there, what the addresses are.